I think EBITDA is bullshit earnings. You're taking earnings and you're adding stuff back to it in a more depreciation heavy industry. So think about Caterpillar. They got all these vehicles, right? Depreciation is a big item on the income statement. When you're looking at EBITDA for a capital intensive industry and you're adding back depreciation, which could be their largest expense item, you get to a number that's bullshit. And there's just no two ways about it.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Kevin O'Brien from Greyfeather. And Kevin, despite his name, is not going to have an Irish accent when you hear him in a couple of minutes here. But instead, we're going to talk about a great case study he has about how he created or helped his client create $2 million in extra EBITDA in 1 year. We're also going to talk about whether, according, like Charlie Munger says, is EBITDA BS earnings. We're going to chat about that, see the pros and cons of it. But I sure as hell want to be EBITDA positive rather than EBITDA negative, which is exactly what Kevin managed to do. That's for sure. I think everyone would agree with that. So, Kevin, why don't you kick us off by telling us something about you that not many people know?
Yeah, great question. I'm a board game nerd. So in addition to being a financial nerd, I really get down on strategic board games and in particular the Euro game. So the strategy is a gene that runs strong with me.
Very good, because I know a friend who is really into this, and he spends quite a bit of money on the physical tables. It's like you can, like any hobby, I guess you can spend infinite money on it. I wouldn't have thought you could spend money much, but he spends thousands on these tables for the purpose. What's your favorite type of board game? Is it a strategy or is it adventure or what's your
definitely stick? Strategy. Yeah, Seven Wonders is a name that's somewhat familiar, but that would probably be at the top of the list as a classic.
And do you have kids? Can you recommend a board game I can get going with my kids? Because
with your kids. That's a good question. Stone Age is a good one. It helps them learn how to do division at a very high level. So maybe more 7-8 years old type of thing.
Okay, I've already had value from this podcast. I get to get on better because we're looking for family activities we can all do together. My kids are 9 or 10 now, so you know, we're getting out of that phase where we're just watching stuff because they're watching it. We're trying to graduate to stuff we can all do at the same time. So board games is on that list. Anyway, enough child rearing and advice.
Absolutely.
So Kevin, just give us a bit of your background. You've got you've got a CPA background, but in addition to that, you've got some extra training, which really informs some of the things we're going to talk about later. Maybe you can give us your background about how you got qualified.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I started as an auditor, worked in audit for about 4 years, really saw the other side of the business and taken a risk-based assessment towards client financials, which I think was really invaluable towards shaping my perspective on business. I always recommend to people who are coming out of college, you know, start with audit and work your way towards being an accountant. And I think it really adds some 360 view into the field and your ability to perform in those positions. From there, I worked in senior corporate accountant as Janus Capital Group, worked as a treasury manager, worked in financial planning and analysis, and ultimately pulled it all together into a controller role at a small business. So I think relative to a lot of other fractional CFOs, I've really worked in different aspects of the finance department. I think there is a differing quality in fractional CFOs where, depending on your path towards hanging your shingle out, potentially you're more accountant heavy or more financial planning and analysis heavy. In my particular case, I think it's a more well-rounded setup of FP&A, treasury, and accounting, which are really three out of the four critical pieces of a finance department.
Okay. So a treasury, as I understand it, is deploying capital for capital-rich companies that have to deploy money. It's figuring out how to make investments. Is that a simplified view of it? How would you characterize?
Yeah, it's managing the banking relationship primarily. A lot of small businesses have a line of credit. Obviously, giving the bank the reporting they need to feel confident in extending that credit and continuing to underwrite that business. Cash forecasting is critical for every small business. So capital planning and making sure that we have a line of sight on where the putt is going to break from a cash perspective so we don't get caught in a flat-footed stance.
Okay, so for a business that's large enough and where a banking relationship is significant enough, I'm guessing like some sort of big construction projects or whatever, you're going to need a dedicated person who's going to manage that relationship and do the reporting just for the bank, basically. That's what it sounds like. You made it sound like
in a larger company, it typically is its own separate segment of the finance department, treasury is. And now in a smaller company, everyone wears more hats, of course. So that's something that typically you see a controller handling, maybe a bookkeeper, not as much. In those cases where you have a bookkeeper on staff, the owner typically plays that banking relationship contact point. So it gets a little bit commingled in a smaller business environment where I either see the owner doing it or the controller doing it, if that makes sense.
So you've got a CFA accreditation as well, as I understand it. And that's a TLA, three-letter acronym. I hear bandied around a lot, but what's your CFA? And maybe you can, if someone sees that on the CV of someone they're thinking about working with when it comes to being a CFO, what does it mean?
Absolutely. CFA Chartered Financial Analyst is what it stands for. It's an international designation. And to be completely candid with you, probably the hardest academic achievement I've ever achieved. CPA was somewhat difficult, but CFA was light worlds more difficult. As a three-year process that you had to take three segments of the exam, goes very far in depth on financial forecasting, discounted cash flows, and things related to investment analysis. So it's really uncommon to see it in the corporate finance realm. The CFA typically lives more so in asset management, portfolio management, and investing. Mm-hmm. I had those aspirations at one point in time, but I'll tell you, the concepts that I learned through that program, I feel like have continued to round out my experience and understanding the big picture on preparing financials. One of the funniest things I'll tell you, James, taking the CPA, they tell you how to put everything into an accrual method, which basically means as earned. And then when I went through the CFA exam, which most people don't do both, they told you how to tear down the accrual earnings and turn it back into cash basis financial and prepare a discounted cash flow analysis. So that was one of those really enlightening topics where it's, who is my customer and why am I producing these financials in a way that they then need to transform?
Oh, you just said something there. That we're gonna trigger some folks if we start talking about this. But this is my personal journey as well. You know, you're told that you're a big boy when you start doing accrual accounting, and your public accountant will tell you that it's great for whatever reasons. And then you try to use it to manage your business, and you start tearing the wall down again because you're like, hold on, I don't know, why is this accrued for? Why is this depreciating? What's the actual? You know, it feels like. I know in theory it makes sense, and I guess it does for tax and all sorts of other reasons, but you're right. Like at the end of the day, it's about, you know, where's the cash flows are about. That's interesting to hear about. So that CFA, I've heard it in terms of people, like you said, using it for like investment decisions, but I know there's a bunch of different acronyms out there, but is this something you're able to use for your own personal investment? Do you do any investing personally and do you use those skills, or is that a totally separate bucket?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm a huge strategy nerd. So investing goes right hand in hand with that. I'm also a sports gambler for what it's worth. But in either case, absolutely. I've analyzed the heck out of every stock you can imagine. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to turn it into making money on it. But that'll be the next step. Apparently, I missed a train on Bitcoin, and where we're at right now was not in line with my investment thesis. Dogecoin was not on my hit list, unfortunately.
So did you take the side that Bitcoin wasn't going to last? We weren't going to be at 100K or wherever it is now when this gets published.
When I continue to think it's maybe a little bit overcooked, I tend to be a contrarian. So whenever we see big sorts of run like this, where you see 100 times multiple from where it was trading years ago, I just tend to be a skeptic in those cases. And obviously I've been on the wrong side of that one.
There's a podcaster called Patrick Boyle. He's a financial podcaster out of London, Irish guy. I met him years and years ago. And he just released a podcast about how they gave a set of investors, or Joe Publix, like they gave them like tomorrow's news from 15 years in history. Like every Wednesday, they would give them like tomorrow's news and tell them to make a trade as if they were on. So they gave them Wednesday's news and they told them to make the trade as if they were the Tuesday. And even knowing, having that, the front page of the FT or whatever it was, they still only became, or like basically 50-50 broke even investing. I'm staying away from that. I'm leaving it for the professionals. Even the professionals seem to find it difficult. So I'm going to stay away. I just stick it in the S&P.
That's a good strategy, especially with yields at 4%. If you can get risk-free 4%, why stretch for these valuations that are at 30 times earnings?
Yeah. And we'll move off this point in a second, but I feel like people lose, they get obsessed with beating the market, which what you really want to do is build a financial plan for yourself, right? So what you really want is an amount, like eventually we all have to have a nest egg that supports us. And that is what's important. And maybe the market's just fine. You accept the market and then go figure out something else to do to make money in the meantime, if you just accept
it. Absolutely. And the final thing I'll say on that, a big part of the CFA program and effectively all of the third section, the third test, was determining the appropriateness of certain investments for different risk profiles. I think for each different individual from an investing perspective, it's critical to define your risk tolerance and your ability to take risk. Somebody who's making $20 an hour isn't going to have the same ability to risk on Bitcoin as maybe a tech founder, if that makes sense. So a good investment for one person might be a different bad investment for a different investor.
Okay, so let's touch on Greyfeather. GreyfeatherCFO.com. Just tell us a bit about your firm today and where were you founded and what stage you're at, et cetera.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I founded Greyfeather CFO about 2.5 years ago, May 17th, 2022. And just was a little bit, I'll say, upset with the corporate environment, working in that environment and working with one manager. In some cases, you do have a limited ability to make a significant impact if your views don't necessarily align with that person who calls the shots. That led ultimately to me wanting to make a bigger impact with my life. So the way I manifested that with my particular skill set is hanging out my shingle to help small businesses spell out what their financials are, define their KPIs, add strategy to their bookkeeping efforts, and ultimately improve the livelihoods of them and their employees, most importantly.
Okay, so you've ventured forth and you found this business that had negative EBITDA of 500K when you found them. Now, first off, let me get something right. So is that the same as making a loss or is there a difference there?
There is in this case. So the EBITDA is bullshit earnings that Charlie Munger says, I think factors in there as well. And I know we'll get there. But in this case, depreciation was not terribly significant. So EBITDA was roughly consistent with net income.
Okay. And let me... Let's not assume anything here. So let's just describe what is EBITDA to get started with from a technical perspective.
Absolutely. EBITDA, E, earnings, B, before, interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. So basically how we're going to do this is we're going to start with the net income figure. That's the bottom line on the income statement. And we're going to add back expenses that were deducted to get to that total, to get to a number that looks a little rosier in most cases than that bottom line net income number. So the expenses we're going to add back are depreciation, interest, and income taxes. And the reason why we do this, that could be a subject of debate, but conceptually, we add back depreciation because it's a non-cash charge. So this is one of those things that we're undoing what the accountants took great care to put onto the books from an accrual perspective to now convert it back to the cash basis to get to a cash flow number that we can use for valuation through discounted cash flows. Okay, so we add back income taxes because the thought is that if you are buying a business, the way that you choose to finance it is a decision of that. So they put everyone on equal apples to apples, comparable perspective relative to whether or not they have debt on their balance sheet or not. And then finally, we add back taxes, which does the same thing that the interest add back does, except it cuts over the way that a entity is formed. So a C corporation is going to show an income tax expense on their books where an S corp will not, because the C corp is a taxable entity where the S corp is not. So what we're effectively doing here is we're getting to a cash number or a cash proxy, I should say, that's comparable across business types and different approaches to financial leverage or debt.
Okay. And we've gone to an EBITDA format in our income statement in the last couple of years. And tell me where I'm wrong here. We did it because it was getting hard to see where the actual operating margin was on the business, like from the normal business operations, selling something and getting paid for it and then having expenses. But then with the depreciation, it was making it really awkward to see how much of the profit is depreciated. And it's because in our case, we depreciate our capital expenses and our software development, which is kind of BS really, to be honest, but because it's still, you've got to pay those developers, but, and they got to eat every month and stuff. But anyway, we stripped it all back. So it's like reversing in a way, some of this accounting decisions which are made. So you can just get back, I guess it's getting back closer to cash at the end of the day, to see what the business really, so it's much more useful from an operating perspective as well, to see your, look at your EBITDA versus your net profit.
Absolutely. And so from a fundamental perspective, when we talk about valuation, all predicated on future cash flows. So what you had just described, the amortization of software costs, et cetera, it only complicates that factor of what the business is actually producing on a cash basis in any given year. So that's where the fundamental joke lies in the financial realm, is that we have the accountants spending all their time coding this information to be as earned on an accrual basis. And then we have our financial planning and analysis folks and our treasury folks converting that back to the cash basis so that they can determine what does this mean from a valuation perspective. So I guess it's the Full Employment Act.
Okay, so let's get out of the textbooks and into the real world. And tell us a bit about this client that you found and what was going wrong for them when you found them.
Well, absolutely, yes. This client, a distribution client, more than $10 million in revenue, reached out to me. They had a circumstance where they were having a very difficult year, inflationary pressures in 2022. That was compounded by an underperforming controller and their lack of transparency into the underlying fundamentals of their business. When I was approached, it was primarily to clean up the books and improve the timeliness of the month-end close process. At that time, it was taking about 20 days to close the books. And when we looked at the financials, there was mismatch between sales and cost of goods sold, which led to distorted gross profit margins from one month to the next. So at the end of the day, they were effectively flying blind. And in addition to that, with the 20-day lag, by the time you're getting a read on how the business is performing, it's already dated information.
Yeah. Okay. So let's say you're a CEO and you don't know any better and your books are 2 months behind. I guess that is a red flag. But how do you know, what are the other red flags that your controller isn't doing what they should be? I mean, that's a pretty big one. But what else was not happening that should have been happening?
Yeah, I'd say a month-end close cycle, if it's taken more than 5 business days, that's a red flag. If a controller or bookkeeper is not pushing financials without having to be requested on a monthly basis, I think that's a red flag. If that financial package doesn't include accountability metrics, well-defined KPIs that tie to the budget, I think there's room for optimization. I wouldn't say that's a red flag because I think that's probably like the extra credit level that we see at businesses and we look to implement ourselves.
So tell me, what were things day to day in the business like in the office when you got there?
Yeah, well, things were quite hectic. The company was under significant financial strain and had just lost $500,000 in EBITDA in the prior year. The lender who had the bank's or the company's primary lending facility was holding the annual renewals for ransom. And they actually decreased the frequency of that to each 6 months. They were asking for capital contributions from the owners. So as you can imagine, we didn't know that this was going to be a successful initiative. And the risk of a forced sale for the owners loomed large.
All right. And okay, so you came in, you identified, obviously, there were problems with the controllers. So what was your process to help turn things around?
Absolutely. All my clients, they started off with a historical profitability analysis. This was an analysis that looks over as long as the accounting records go back. So in this case, I think we were looking back to 2010. And looking at data over that long of a time span, I think is something that business owners aren't used to doing. Typically, we're looking at this year's budget versus actuals. And it can be a situation where you have blinders on in some cases, where we're looking at what the company has evolved into without really seeing the big picture of where were we and where are we now. And what are the key drivers that changed what was a good year 10 years ago to what's a terrible year this year? So ultimately, looking at that bird's eye view of historical profitability analysis over more than a decade and talking with the owners about it, we're able to define which key performance metrics really impacted the business from a good year to a bad year. Okay, so from that, we define the KPIs. We build into the month-end close process a KPI scorecard or dashboard, which adds accountability. It ties the company's budget, where they've defined what their targets are for those key performance indicators that we measured, puts those targets right against the monthly trends and how they're actually performing across those. So every month is now in your face. This is what we said we were going to do in our budget. Here's where we're landing. And it forces the conversation and accountability that is lacking in a lot of small businesses' month-end close cycle.
Okay, so let me review there. So you do a historical sort of trawl, let's say, of the data. Then you have an idea, you identify which KPIs are really the drivers. And in a distribution business like this, like what are some examples of what those KPIs might be?
Gross profit margin, biggest one for a distributor. They buy and they sell, right? So how efficiently are we doing that and how profitably are we doing that? So in this particular case, gross profit margins had suffered substantially. Now, obviously, gross profit margin encapsulates a number of different things, material and labor. Since it is such a critical measure in this particular business, we broke it down one step further looking at the material cost and then the production labor as a percentage of sales.
Okay. And having gone doing that historical trawl, are you then able to show the owner, hey, your services or your costs used to be at this level, and then show them what's happening and why they're getting in trouble? Because I guess it's very easy to get boiled like a frog fairly slowly, and your advertising cost goes up, but your cost of goods goes up slowly, not much, 5% each year. But before you know it, you're wondering why you're losing $500,000 in EBITDA every year.
Absolutely. 100%. And that's exactly what we found. The material costs had gone up 10 points as a percentage of sales. Now, obviously, we were coming off a significantly inflationary pressure 2022. So there was some noise in that number for sure. But at least identifying that, here is where the erosion in our profit has happened. Okay, we've lost 10 points on material cost. Are we being efficient about passing these cost increases through to our customers? Do we have the right person in the right seat from a purchasing perspective? And asking these critical questions that when you talk about 10 points of sales and you talk about 10 million of annual sales, you're talking about $1 million opportunity per year.
Yeah. Okay.
So really, I think raising the issue, spelling it out as the biggest issue magnitude wise, and asking the questions about, are we doing everything as efficiently as we can? That's where we lead to team outcomes that can really impact the profitability of the business.
Okay, so you did this, you put in your KPIs, and then, but that in and of itself doesn't create the turnaround. So what were the practical steps, having had that in place, that were taken to create this turnaround?
Absolutely. In this particular case, replacing the purchasing manager with a stronger purchasing manager who really excelled in that area, leading RFPs, having a continual process improvement mindset, I think made probably the biggest change. Also, looking through those numbers, we did see that the production labor had increased substantially over a period of years, right-sizing that and making sure that things are being done in an efficient way, in line with profitable years. I think those two key items, and then team buy-in and ownership buy-in to doing the hard work that actually is required, having the tough conversations that is required to actually turn that around and make it from being a weakness to a strength for the company is really what impacts the organization. So 100%, your fractional CFO can spell it out for you, but if you don't have the ownership and team buy-in, it's not going to go anywhere.
Okay. So in this instance, which doesn't sound that unfamiliar in a lot of stories I've heard, is that sometimes it's the process, sometimes it's the team, and sometimes it's just like the actual individual performance and people anneal into their job over time, and maybe it's time to shake things up, and there's no pretty way of saying that, but you just need to put the right people in the right seats.
Yep, absolutely. It's always a team effort. And if there is a lack of teamwork, that's where I think you have a fundamental inability to achieve the profitable outcomes that you otherwise could.
This is where it's emotionally difficult, right? Because you're saying, yeah, it's a team, but sometimes people are getting off the team. That's the thing. And anytime you do that, that obviously impacts everyone who's left. You'll be able to get a manage through that. So it's tough, but then that's what you need to do to survive. So what was the impact then 12 months later, 18 months later? What sort of shape was the business in? And what impact did that have day-to-day working in that business?
Absolutely. Yeah, so new purchasing manager came on, asking questions that hadn't been asked before, fresh set of eyes, leveraging suppliers to get the best price, not taking anything for granted. We also brought in a freight broker, compared against two or three different freight brokers, make sure we're getting the best freight rates. Number of different items, you know, obviously the production labor, implementing monitoring to make sure that didn't climb above the agreed upon percentage, the target in the budget. Those things working in concert over time had a huge compounding effect. So what we saw where we lost $500,000 of EBITDA in the most recently completed year, we turned 1.5 positive of EBITDA. So a $2 million turnaround from negative $500,000 to plus $1.5 million. The cumulative compounding impact of continual process improvement initiatives across the team.
Okay. And so now let's get on to it. We're all just saying how great it was to create all this EBITDA. And Charlie Munger says it's BS earnings. So what does he mean when he say that? Why does he say that?
Well, I actually agree with him. I think EBITDA is bullshit earnings. So at the end of the day, you're taking earnings and you're adding stuff back to it. These are real costs. Okay. You have depreciation for your business. All right. And I understand that's a non-cash number. But when you bought the piece of equipment, it wasn't non-cash. Okay. So I think there is a line of thought, and I actually agree with it, that EBITDA excludes a number of items that are very true costs for a business. So now it's not across the board egalitarian. What I'll say about this is, in a more depreciation heavy industry, so think about Caterpillar, all right? You know, they got all these vehicles, right? Depreciation is a big item on the balance sheet, or the income statement, I should say. When you're looking at EBITDA for a capital intensive industry, and you're adding back depreciation, which could be their largest expense item, you get to a number that's bullshit. And there's just no two ways about it. Okay. In another environment, if you're working with a financial services company, depreciation is not significant at all. They might be depreciating some cubicles and a few computers, but their EBITDA is going to be much higher quality relative to their net income than a more capital intensive industry.
Okay.
Now, I will say, I agree. Charlie Munger is right on point. And I think he said adjusted EBITDA is bullshit, which is taking one extra step and it's saying, hey, now I'm going to normalize for everything that I don't feel like was actually fair, which is completely ridiculous. But in either case, EBITDA has become the standard, okay? And it is the standard. If you talk to a business broker and you talk about a transaction that's happening, we're talking about EBITDA, multiples of EBITDA. So unfortunately, it's a necessary evil. And I agree with Charlie Munger, but this one has won out and we're all living in the world of EBITDA, unfortunately.
Yes, yeah, it seems weird to me. Like everyone worships at the altar of Berkshire Hathaway and their annual shareholder meetings. And we all agree. And yet everyone turns around and just goes back to totally ignoring what they're saying. It's just like a cultural thing. I guess it's been driven by the bankers maybe, because it's a more like a finance way of looking at things.
I think the business brokers in particular, when they're looking at a business, they're talking to their buyer about multiples over EBITDA. Mm-hmm. And then also, I think you hit the nail on the head with the bankers too. When you talk about covenants, a lot of times you're seeing leverage covenants and coverage covenants that do start with EBITDA or have EBITDA as the denominator. So I agree. We're going to have to send this one to our senator and talk to the powers that be.
Very good. All right. Listen, you've written on a lot of these topics, including building out budgets on your blog. How can people find your website and your blog, where there's a lot of good writings there, I've noticed?
Yeah, absolutely. GrayFeatherCFO.com, G-R-A-Y, GrayFeatherCFO.com. I have a blog section there, a few thought pieces. And if anyone should feel to reach out, please send me an email or an inquiry through the website.
Great. And then I have a traditional question to wrap up here, Kevin, which is, who's your business hero, if you have one, and why?
I'll go Jack Welch on that one. As you can see, I have a winning here in my library. Actually, I bought this copy fresh out of college at a thrift store. I think I paid a dollar for it. And I'll tell you, I've never gotten a better value, education versus cost. Really incredible read at a very formative time in my career. What I love about Jack Welch, he's direct, he's candid, and he doesn't polish things. He'll tell you how it is. And I think that's aligns with my personality type. It's not necessarily for everyone. I tend to be a little bit more direct. But I think ultimately that was a really pivotal book for my career development, to understand that saying what you mean and being candid is not something to be ashamed of. It's something to be proud of.
Interesting. Would you like Jack Welch's life? What's the trade-off there? Do you think he's paid a price for what he's achieved?
I think I'd take my life right now, but I think he had an exceptional one. And if I could carve half of the legacy that he did, I'd be happy.
Yeah, very good. All right. Thanks, Kevin. And thank you for listening to the Gross Profit Podcast. We appreciate you staying with us. Your special reward is to be able to go to grayfeathercfo.com, check out the blog, and also go to procurementexpress.com/partners. I've created a webinar. It's my two cents on how a fractional CFO can best explain their value to CEOs in a way that they'll understand. So check it out and let me know what you think. And Kevin, this has been fun. Thanks for coming along.
Likewise. Appreciate you, James.